Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. Meshkegawut Council has declared a state of emergency after a rash of youth suicides around the James Bay coast in Ontario. First Nations part of the council recently held a summit to discuss preventive measures. A father in Ontario is worried about his daughter after his ex-girlfriend was deported to St. Lucia and was able to take their daughter with her. The 26-year-old father from Henvey Inlet First Nation speaks out. And the First Nations Wellness Addictions Counselor Certification Board in BC is hoping to reach more frontline workers in First Nation communities throughout the country. The new executive director spoke with Bomsida. And the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nation wants to put a stop to all industry permits in the province or halt them until First Nations are consulted properly and are able to participate in industry activities in their traditional territories. And he's been known for his shoot-from-the-hip style and straight talk, and for the past couple of decades has been promoting economic development as the way for First Nations self-sufficiency. A Soyuz Indian Band Chief Clarence Louis has been reappointed as chair of the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board. All these stories plus great tunes coming right after the news. Here's your National Aboriginal News. The Meshkegawut Council in Ontario has declared a state of emergency due to a recent rash of youth suicides. The Timmins Daily Press reports that in the last year alone, there have been more than a dozen suicides committed in communities from around the James Bay coast. Grand Chief Stan Ludit says there are two parts to the emergency declaration. He says in the first part, leaders are calling on themselves and their communities to address this emergency. The second part, Ludit says, requires the help from the provincial and federal governments.
We know that there are certain other things that we need help on. And this is where we're calling upon the federal and provincial government to work with us, to partner with us, to find solutions with us. We don't want them to be a hindrance in regards to the process. We want them to work with us and to be able to work together to find solutions. And maybe together we can make a difference.
Ludit says so far they've had positive dialogue with Health Canada and nothing yet from the Provincial Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs. Housing programs in Newfoundland and Labrador are getting a hand up. The federal government recently announced it's investing $1.7 million for retrofit work on 125 housing units, including cooperative housing and nonprofit housing in those regions. The funding is part of Canada's economic action plan. Sask Power, three First Nations and a private development company are looking into a 250-megawatt hydroelectric project on the Saskatchewan River system. But first, the groups need to study the feasibility of the project. The First Nation groups, along with their development partners, Brookfield Renewable Power and Peter Kiewit Sons and Company, have recently reached the agreement with Sask Power. Should the project prove feasible, the First Nations private developer partnership would develop the site, build the power plant, and enter into a long-term power purchase agreement with Sask Power. James Parker with Sask Power says the feasibility study will take about 4 years to complete and will cost about $12 million. The Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations Vice Chief Lyle Whitefish and George Gordon First Nation Chief Glenn Pratt have put the province on notice that they will not tolerate any more exploration permits on traditional lands. In a statement, the FSIN says many Saskatchewan First Nations, including George Gordon, have entered into agreements with the federal government to resolve their treaty land entitlement claims. FSIN Vice Chief Lyle Whitefish says the groups want to participate in industry activities on traditional lands.
So we're wanting to participate in industry. We want to work with them. We want to be a part of the game, part of the plan. And it seems that this provincial government is throwing obstacles in front of us and preventing us from participating. So we hope that we can have some good dialogue.
Whitefish says the groups met with provincial officials on May 18th, and he hopes issues can start to be resolved without going to court. He adds the chiefs will continue to pressure the province to acknowledge their traditional territories and the duty to consult. A 26-year-old Henvey Inlet First Nation man wants his daughter back. Over a long custody battle, his nearly three-year-old daughter has been deported with her mother to the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. Nathan McQuabby says a measure in a temporary custody order was rescinded to allow his daughter to leave Ontario just after his ex-girlfriend was denied refugee status. He says before the order was rescinded, his daughter had been staying with him for about 4 months with little or no contact from the mother.
Since that order was rescinded, my daughter was allowed then to leave the province of Ontario with Miss Noel, because in there it stated Mikayla was not to be removed from the province of Ontario due to my access rights. Once that emergency motion was put in place, Miss Noel then gained the assistance of the OPP to come and apprehend my daughter.
Nathan says he has also requested the assistance of his First Nation to get his daughter back. Henvey Inlet First Nation Chief Wayne McQuabby says he doesn't feel enough stress was put on the fact that Nathan's daughter is a First Nations child.
Yes, those comments were made in respect of that, but it almost seemed to be ignored. St. Lucia's poverty level there is very high. This child, if it would have remained with the First Nation, you know, the possibility of education, healthcare, cultural teachings, our way of life would have been instilled in that child.
Chief McQuabby says the community will support Nathan any way it can, and Nathan says his ultimate goal is to get his daughter back. In Ontario, First Nations are taking more action against the harmonized sales tax. And according to the Toronto Sun, NDP leader Jack Layton says the federal and provincial governments are needlessly provoking potentially disruptive action by area First Nations. Batchewana First Nation is threatening to block railway traffic, and Garden River First Nation plans to collect tolls on highways through its territory. Layton told reporters last week that he will try to convince the Prime Minister he can avoid those conflicts if he takes action now. First Nations in the province want to maintain their point of sale exemption when the harmonized sales tax kicks in on July 1st. Breakfast Clubs of Canada will be extending its programs to First Nations in Ontario and Alberta. The BCC has recently signed an agreement with the Assembly of First Nations. The Winnipeg Free Press reports the program is already underway in some communities. It's also set to launch this week in Whitefish Bay First Nation in Ontario, where 300 students will be reached. By the end of this year, the breakfast program will reach 17 First Nation communities in five provinces, including BC, Ontario, Alberta, Manitoba, and Quebec, to serve 4,500 kids. The goal is to nearly triple the program in 3 years to serve about 1,200 kids. The paper also reports it costs an average of $60,000 annually to run the program in First Nations communities, with an initial investment of between $15,000 to $25,000 for kitchen appliances. The organization does not receive government funding. The Sprott Foundation granted the BCC $100,000 for First Nations and Aboriginal school breakfast programs in Ontario and Alberta. Assembly of First Nations National Chief John Atleo has joined Regional Chief Rick Simon and Wakamatuk First Nation Chief Lester Peck in calling for a public inquiry into the death of John Simon. Simon was shot in his home by an RCMP officer in December 2008. Atleo says the death of John Simon and the subsequent report about police conduct and the death justifies the need for a full and independent public inquiry. He adds that the family and the community will never have closure until an open and transparent process can provide a full understanding of the circumstances surrounding this tragic death. Atleo is hopeful that the Premier and other officials will reconsider their decision and answer the call for a public inquiry. The Wagmatook Band and the Simon family have repeatedly called for a public inquiry, and Chief Lester Peck says more than a year after Simon's death, the community has more questions than answers. The family and community have also been concerned about the RCMP's role in the preparation of the Halifax Regional Police Services report on the incident. A Soyuz Indian Band Chief Clarence Louie has been reappointed as chairperson of the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board for another three-year term. Chief Louie says focus is on youth and industry.
Of course, we focus on the youth. I mean, the youngest and fastest growing population is Aboriginal youth in the country, in every province. Trying to focus on getting Aboriginal youth involved in entrepreneurship and economic development and major resources. mining oil, gas.
Louis says with a focus on the economy everywhere in mainstream Canada, he would like to see Aboriginal people participate in the economy in all regions. The National Aboriginal Economic Development Board serves as a link between policymakers, legislators, government departments, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal businesses. The board advises government on Aboriginal economic development issues. And that's your National Aboriginal News. With Courage Song. The Meshkekawat Council near the James Bay coast in Ontario has declared itself in a state of emergency. There has been about 6 suicides in the community along the coast, with many more attempts, and all have been youth. And Stan Ludit, Grand Chief of the Meshkekawat Council, says one suicide is too many. He says the state of emergency was recently declared after a 2-day summit on the issue. Now, he says, there's a lot of work to do in the communities, and they're also appealing to the provincial and federal governments for help.
Recently in Moose Factory, one of our communities of the Meshkagwa Council, we held an emergency summit on the state of suicides within our communities. And it was a two-day summit where we brought together leadership, community members, frontline workers, and the general public to talk about the suicide epidemic that's been happening in our communities. And we had a lot of feedback. We had a lot of discussions with from the people that were there. And one of the things that came out of that two-day summit was that the people indicated that due to the seriousness of the situation, that we should declare a state of emergency, which we did. We've issued a press release, and we will be serving notice to the federal and provincial governments to indicate to them that there is an emergency here, that we need to deal with this issue, and that we need to work together. The declaration is basically in two areas. Number one is that we do realize that there are certain things that we ourselves as leaders, as communities, as families, as frontline workers, that we can do. We do realize that there's things that we can do within our communities. We can have forums, we can have summits, we can have meetings, we can have one-on-one sessions, we can have youth forums, elder forums, family forums. We can do all of those things. It doesn't take money. All it takes is a commitment to move ahead. So we're calling upon ourselves as leaders and as communities and as people to do something about this. The second part of that is, while we're doing those things ourselves, and we know that there are certain other things that we need help on, and this is where we're calling upon the federal and provincial government to work with us, to partner with us, to find solutions with us. We don't want them to be a hindrance in regard to the process. We want them to work with us to be able to work together to find solutions. And maybe together we can make a difference. So that's what the declaration is all about. And hopefully we can make some progress today. Right now, as we speak, my staff is preparing the documentation that we can submit to the federal and provincial government, indicating to them that we wish to conduct a public inquiry in regard to the suicide epidemic, and that we will require the resources for us to be able to do that, to go to the communities and have hearings, and to come up with a plan in terms of how this issue can be dealt with in the short term, medium term, long term as well.
And when are you expecting or hoping that this will happen?
We are hoping that this will happen very quickly. A lot of times when the federal government is involved, when our provincial government is involved, and you submit proposals to them and ideas, they take their time, and they'll take weeks, months, and sometimes even years to try and make this thing, make things move. And we're hopeful that due to the seriousness of this situation, that the federal and provincial governments will act quickly, that there was going to be a swift turnaround time, and that we begin working. And that's what I am hoping for, that we can establish this commission at a minimum within the next two months. I don't want to be waiting 6 months or a year and fighting with the government and trying to get them to understand what we're going through. We want them to treat this as a priority as well, to work with us in finding solutions.
Okay, and how many people have died in the area along the James Bay in the past year, for instance?
I don't have the statistics on me right now, but within the past year, we have had approximately six or seven suicides in the region the past year. Six or seven is a lot. One is too many, and I think we need to begin dealing with those things. And even though there's been that many completed suicides, there are countless others where there's been serious attempts, and even those are very, very disturbing.
Are these young people?
The statistics that we have now indicates that the age of concern or the age where this epidemic is taking place is between the ages of 15 and 24. So, yes, the people most affected by this is the youth.
That was Stan Ludit, Grand Chief of the Meshkegawa Council. Last month, a woman was deported to the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. While that's not so unusual, she was able to bring her young daughter with her. But that young daughter is also the daughter of a First Nations citizen, Nathan McQuabby of Henvey Inlet First Nation in Ontario. And it all began with a lengthy custody battle, and the mother was a landed immigrant. The custody battle went on for about 2 years, and just after the 29-year-old woman was deported, the courts rescinded a clause in a temporary custody order to allow the almost 3-year-old Mikayla to leave the province of Ontario with her mother. And all the father wants is to have his daughter back. Here's Nathan McQuabby to explain what happened.
Her lawyer submitted an emergency motion to rescind the temporary custody order that was currently in place. The temporary custody order stated that Ms. Noel had had custody of Mikayla, and I was to have access rights every second weekend of the month, every 2 weeks, starting from when that temporary order was put in place. Now, since that order was rescinded, my daughter was allowed then to leave on province of Ontario with Ms. Noel, because in there it stated Mikayla was not to be removed from the province of Ontario due to my access rights. Once that emergency motion was put in place, Ms. Noel then gained the assistance of the OPP to come and apprehend my daughter. Now, at that particular point in time, there wasn't anything that I could do about it. Well, nothing legally, but still, that would just exacerbate things and just make life difficult for everyone.
But I understand that she was staying with you since December 09, so, and she had a temporary custody order? Because I'm a little confused.
No. Mikayla was in my full care since December 15th of 2009. However, nothing was changed with the temporary custody order. Ms. Noel still had custody of Mikayla. However, she somehow irresponsibly lost Mikayla's spot at daycare, and that led to Ms. Noel needing my assistance further to take Mikayla so that she can go to work and continue her daily life. Now, at the time, I wasn't employed, but even once I gained employment, I was still able to manage Mikayla and my job at the same time without any difficulty. Since December 15th, I was both mother and father to her 24/7.
Was that ever brought up in court?
Yeah, those details were brought up to Judge Klein, and he did recognize the fact that my relationship with Mikayla was improving and that my situation, both with a stable home and income, were improving because of my recent employment. Now, I've always had a stable home with my grandmother, whom I reside with, but there was always a financial issue, so I was forced to seek employment outside of the community and whatnot. But yeah, the courts were informed of the fact that I was time caretaker of Mikayla.
And the other issue here is that Mikayla is a First Nations child of my right. She has a status under the Indian Act, and she is a band member, so she has status, and her name is on the birth certificate. So I don't understand how she was able to be deported to another country, being that she is a First Nations child, and I wonder if that was ever brought up in court.
The courts were aware of that Mikayla was a full status native and registered with Henvey Inlet First Nation. I'm not entirely too sure what they were thinking at the time when they made the decision to let Mikayla go with mother, but as the way I see it, Mikayla is now illegally in St. Lucia. She doesn't have her citizenship there. However, she was born a Canadian citizen, and she did get her status card, which was...
And considering that you're also a member of Henvey Inlet First Nation and reside here as well, is Chief and Council going to help you in any way try and fight to get your daughter back?
Well, there have been some ideas tossed around back and forth. There's nothing really permanent now because no one's ever dealt with a situation like this. So what's probably going to happen is we're going to notify St. Lucian government, their social services. So if anything were to go wrong with her current situation in St. Lucia, that she should be sent back here to reside where she belongs.
Are you going to try and get her back here, though?
That's basically the ultimate plan. Just trying to figure out how to go about it is another problem that we have.
So did you know at all or have any kind of idea that Shauna was going to be deported with your daughter?
Well, I supported regardless of what the situation was. I just didn't know whether or not my daughter was going with her, because I had confidence in the courts that they would do what was in Mikayla's best interest. And what was in Mikayla's best interest was to remain here in the country where she could receive both education and health benefits for pretty much her entire life. Instead, an emergency motion was signed that allowed her to leave the country with her mother to a place that is more poverty-stricken than any reservation here in Canada. They have no healthcare. They have no education system. I read in some demographics that only 23% of their children are educated, and that 23% are, you know, the rich half. The family exploit everyone else to make their money. And that was just some of the recent studies that have been done. Those were done in 2008, so I don't know if anything's been changed since then.
And what was your reaction to the deportation? You were saying that the cops came and got my Mikayla, and there's, you know, a great big to-do about it. What was your reaction?
Well, I really couldn't have any reaction except to be, you know, remain calm and collected. It wouldn't benefit anyone if I just went off the tangent, you know, started yelling around and causing trouble. No, that wouldn't have worked out, no.
How did your daughter react?
My daughter didn't. She's 2.5 years old. She's about to turn 3 in July. She didn't know any better. She thought she was just going for a car ride, you know? She didn't know that she wasn't not see daddy anymore.
So from the time that you had her in, from December 15th, had she had much contact with her mother?
Well, like I said, her mother before December 15th was, she had full custody of her. They were residing together in Parry Sound through Native Housing. She attended daycare regularly. However, like I said, Miss Noel lost her spot at daycare. So that's how I ended up with full-time care. But during that first two-year period, I was in regular contact with Mikayla. I'd exercise my access rights on the weekends, and in most cases, the majority of the time, I would end up with Mikayla for more than what was assigned by the temporary order. So instead of every second weekend, I'd have her for like weeks on end because her mother just couldn't handle her.
But did she have contact, or did the mom come and see Mikayla or come and get her during the time that she was in your care from December till she was deported?
No, whenever Mikayla was in my care, Miss Noel was pretty much nowhere to be found. She phoned me, and I could never contact her because she never gave me her information, and I was the one always picking her up and dropping her off at her mother's house, so.
That was Nathan McQuabby discussing how his daughter was able to stay in the custody of her mother when she was deported to St. Lucia. McQuabby was also unrepresented in court after firing his lawyer some time ago. Meanwhile, the chief of Henvey Inlet First Nation, Wayne McQuabby, says the community will support Nathan any way they can to help him repatriate his daughter. The Canada Services Border Agency did not respond at Bombsida's production time. Don Amaro is on tour right now across Canada, and he has tour dates in PEI, Ontario, Manitoba, and Alberta from now until June 11th. Here's Sunshine and Rain from Don Amaro's CD, Deepening.
Have you ever watched the sunrise at the break of day? The light that's falling over scares the dark away. That's how it feels when I am with you. Have you ever felt spring showers wash away the mud? The air is so much sweeter when the flowers start to
Nation's Wellness Addictions Counselor Certification Board is expanding its program. New offices have been set up, and the board is hoping that it will make it easier to reach and help certify more First Nations wellness and addictions counselors throughout the country. Vince Battistelli is the new executive director.
We've actually been serving nationally, but what we want to do is ensure that we're doing that more effectively than we have in the past, and that means being able to ensure that we're in touch with people in various treatment organizations throughout the country, and making sure that they have more direct access to us, and that they have better information about our programs and easier access. So we're taking what we've been doing and really trying to make it more effective than we believe that it has been to date.
Okay, and what programs are you talking about?
Well, we are we're a certification body. So essentially what we do is to certify wellness and addiction counselors who meet certain criteria to be able to receive the certification. So what we're doing is essentially there are a set of criteria, and there's some standards or application form and what have you that they would fill out, and once they've got all the information in, we would then go ahead and review that to determine whether or not they're appropriate. And for some people who were already certified, they're certification expires within about 2 or 3 weeks, and so we review that if they're interested in being recertified. So that's basically the program that is available to the people who the frontline wellness and addiction workers. But what we also do is we look across the country for programs in colleges and elsewhere, workshops, training events that would be appropriate for people to take to help them gain more knowledge and skills in the work that they're doing. And we look at those programs to see if, in fact, we think they're appropriate and that would contribute to a person having, you know, more better knowledge and better skills. And if we believe that's the case, after reviewing those courses or workshops, then we will essentially lend our names to those courses, meaning that we have reviewed them and we will accept them as a part of the certification program.
Okay, and we're talking about wellness and addictions workers now. Are we talking about just in the urban centers or?
No, we're talking about First Nations wellness and addiction workers throughout Canada and the territories. So, and that's part of our sort of greater thrust nationally is to try to reach areas where we may not have been reaching up to date. And so to discover where those are and then to make sure that we're getting our information out to people.
So has your certification become a requirement for some of those positions, communities?
It may be that some organizations are saying in order to be, I'm not sure if it means in order to be, to work here. I think that it's being used in some organizations to increase people's pay, that if they've taken a course and are certified, they might earn more money in their job. And I'm not sure if some organizations are saying you have to have this certification in order to work here. I'm brand new to this. I've only been working with the organization about just a little over a month now. So I don't know if there are some organizations who are using that approach.
That was Vince Battistelli, Executive Director of the First Nations Wellness Addictions Counselor Certification Board. The Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations and George Gordon First Nation have put the province on notice that they will no longer tolerate permits in First Nation traditional territories. The groups maintain there has not been acknowledgement or consultation in traditional lands when it comes to issuing permits to industries. Lyle Whitefish is the Vice Chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations.
It's been an ongoing issue between ourselves and province about lands in some of our traditional territories that we've been claiming as our traditional lands. And what's been happening in the past is that this province continued to issue permits on those traditional territories without consulting us and without having our involvement as to how many there are, who's receiving them, and where we can play a part in terms of the participation in some of those permits, exploration permits or industry permits. We want to have a fair, equitable participation in some of that work that's happening within our lands. And of course, we use the duty to consult as part of our argument against this province. And we've been, yesterday we held a rally. It was overwhelming support for people in Saskatchewan, First Nations people. And the other issue is, of course, the sale of protected lands in this province. There's a number of Crown lands that are protected. And it seems that those lands are going up for sale. It seems that we don't have an opportunity to participate in the purchase of those lands.
And some of that has to do with being able to resolve the treaty land entitlement?
Those are the treaty land entitlement issues and bands that are interested in some of those lands. And, of course, there are some bands going through specific claims.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those claims, like our fear is that we won't have the choice lands we require to fulfill our shortfall acres in this province.
And if you were able to get access to these lands like you want to, it would be somebody saying suitable for economic development. And what sort of economic development projects would people like to see in the territories?
Well, there's lots of exploration. There's lots of potential for mining in this province. Some of the upcoming participation we want to be included in is, of course, oil and gas, and the other mineral that's very lucrative that's coming forth is the potash industry and the potash mines in Saskatchewan. And some of those potash beds lie on our First Nations and traditional territories. So we're wanting to participate, like I said earlier, in industry. We want to work with them. We want to be a part of the game, part of the plan, and it seems that this provincial government throwing obstacles in front of us and preventing us from participating. Hope to have some good dialogue. Had a meeting with them yesterday. and that we can start to resolve some of these issues without going to court, because we're going to be very adamant in our stand in province. As First Nations and the chiefs are concerned about the direction of this government, in that we will continue to pressure the province to acknowledge our traditional territories and, of course, the duty to consult.
And how about industry? Will you be knocking on their doors and letting them know what's going on?
Yes, we have met with a couple of industry officials, and we had a very successful meeting with them, and I was very impressed with the way they consult with the First Nations in this province. A couple companies that are working in the north are they set a good example of what duties consult and accommodation is, so I was very impressed with them. We will continue to meet with other industry groups and hopefully attract some Asian investors, Chinese investors into some of our territories. And we did sign a hydroelectric agreement with some of our First Nations in the province. So that's great. We're moving forward in terms of working with industry. But it's some of those key areas that we still need to work in terms of dialogue, in terms of understanding, and in terms of having us come to the table and talking about some of those key issues we can resolve with this province.
And what about the federal government's role in all of this, since they would have precedence over the province?
Well, we certainly hope so. We want to work with both levels of government on duty to consult and on traditional lands, traditional territories, because it's become law. The Supreme Court ruling have stated that both levels of government have to consult with us on a number of issues on our lands, and that's not happening here in Saskatchewan.
That was Lyle Whitefish, Vice Chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. Now here's Sandy Schofield with Money is the Goal.
Poison is when
He's been known for his shoot-from-the-hip style and straight talk. He's been known to say such things as, the biggest employer shouldn't be the band office in First Nation communities. You're going to lose your language and culture a lot faster in poverty than you will in economic development. And the single most important key to First Nation self-reliance is economic development. He's been spouting phrases such as those for a couple of decades. And of course, I'm talking about Soyuz Indian Band Chief Clarence Louie. He's been reappointed as chair of the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board. Chief Louie spoke with Bomsida about the board's function and focus.
Now, it's a government board appointed to order and council. It was established back in the early 90s, and it deals with Aboriginal economic development funding for Inuit, Métis, and First Nations people across the country.
And what kind of work has evolved from there?
Well, it's a source of funding, grant funding for Aboriginal economic development, where either First Nation bands or organizations that are First Nations, Aboriginal, or Inuit, or Métis apply for. It's a whole process of application to have your, and there's a whole system of offices set up across the country to contribute dollars towards Aboriginal economic development. And I think the budget's around $40-50 million a year that goes out.
Okay, and what kind of businesses have successfully applied?
Oh, hundreds of them. Small businesses, individual Aboriginal entrepreneurs, all sorts from, I mean, you name it. But it has to be approved. You don't just apply and think you're going to automatically get it. There's a whole bureaucracy involved, a whole approval process, business plan, and all of that kind of stuff. And, of course, there's limited funding. There's more demand on the funding than there is funding, like in any major corporations. Aboriginal corporations apply, sawmills, mining, coffee shops, from small businesses to large businesses.
In the last couple of years, the country has been in a recession, and we know that most First Nation communities have been there for a really long time. And have you seen the demand go up for funding as far as entrepreneurs go?
The demand is, as far as the Aboriginal, the ABC funding, it's always given out. It's always over the amount of funding available. And of course, since most First Nations sit there with 50% or more unemployment, which Great Depression numbers, and you know, it's, the board members are selected from across the country. Some are Métis, some are Inuit, some are First Nation, and we push the Aboriginal economic development file that the government, you know, social spending without economic development is a waste of money.
Mm-hmm. And how many people are on your board?
I think currently there's around 12. I might be wrong in the number, and that the capacity is upwards of, I think, 18. But I might be wrong in that number, too.
Okay, and how often do you meet?
As a full board, we meet, I mean, every year is different. There's no set amount of times that we have to meet, but we meet on the average 4 times a year.
What are the current trends?
The current trends?
Yeah, and economic development.
Of course, we focus on the youth. I mean, the youngest and fastest growing population is Aboriginal youth in the country, in every province. Trying to focus on getting Aboriginal youth involved in entrepreneurship and economic development, and a major resource, mining, oil, and gas. Many Aboriginal communities are remote. You know, so their chance of opening up a bit because of the remoteness factor, of course, you know, most businesses depend on having a location with the infrastructure. Most Aboriginal communities don't have that, so mm-hmm. Many Aboriginal communities are getting involved in the natural resource sector with the mining and oil companies and pipeline companies and diamond mines, for example.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's it for me. And is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
No, thanks for calling. I mean, it's good to see that that your station, and you know, from what I read in some of the media outlets, from some of the media, whether it's newspaper or radio or TV, that Aboriginal Economic Development is starting to get to become a priority and getting more of the limelight. That it's funny how non-native people, the economy is always the number one issue. Every year, every month, I don't care what region you're in, what municipality you're in, the economy is what determines the standard of living of that region.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to see first the Aboriginal people become part of the economy in every region.
That was Clarence Louis, chief of the Osoyoos Indian Band in BC and chair of the National Aboriginal Economic Development Board. You've been listening to Bomb Siddha with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Siddha is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal arts. Bomb Siddha means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddha.